Okay, let's start, like I said, with the Haftorah portion. And if you're not sure what this one is, it is going to come this time from the book of Samuel. In this case, the Hebrew Bible just leaves all of Samuel together, I'm pretty sure anyway, but it's 1 Samuel in most English Bibles. Let's start with chapter 12, really. That's where I think it's most interesting. It actually starts a couple verses earlier than that. But this is the story of the, I guess you'd call it, address that Samuel gave at the coronation of King Saul. Now, you remember the story. We see this in 1 Samuel chapter 8, where Samuel was told by Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, hey, they have not rejected you, Samuel. They have rejected me for being king over them. This is one of those things that I describe as probably about the second major recorded vote in Scripture. And Saul was elected by acclamation. As we know, it wasn't the best choice they could have made. So here's that story, but I do want to introduce it with one other little commentary that I, just in case I forget to mention it later. We're going to talk tonight in the Torah portion about Korach. And of course, the infamous rebellion and what happened did not work out so well for Korah or Korach in the Hebrew and those that followed him. But an interesting thing, not all of Korah's sons followed him to when the earth literally opened up its mouth and took them down alive. So some of the sons of Korah became faithful servants of Yah and served among the Levites. And that's a blessed thing. They also wrote some of the Psalms. We'll come back to all of that. But it turns out, and I had, I guess, forgotten this, but and looking through and getting ready for tonight, it was reminded to me that Samuel, the prophet, is in fact a descendant of the sons of Korah. So that's at least part of the connection here. So let's talk about what it is that Samuel had to say when he was having anointed Saul king. He made one other famous anointment, of course, and that was later King David. Indeed, he said to all of Israel, I have heeded your voice and the things you said to me. Yep, you got a king, and now here he is, walking before you. I'm old and gray-headed. Look, some of my sons are with you, and I've walked before you from my childhood until now. So here I am. So he asks them to witness before Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, and before his anointed, have I done anything? Now, we see similar things like this. I think Moshe at one point makes a similar statement. It's not the first time that somebody says, look, have I taken any stuff? Have I cheated anybody? Whom have I oppressed? From whose hand have I received a bribe? If I have, I'll restore it to you. And they said, no, you haven't cheated us. You haven't oppressed us. You haven't taken anything from any man's hand. And he said, okay, so Yahuwah is witness against you, and his anointed is witness this day that you have not found anything in my hand. And they answered, yep, you got it. He is witness. So Samuel then said to the same folks, it is Yahuwah who raised up Moshe and Aaron, who brought your fathers out of the land of Mitzrayim. So therefore, stand still, that I can basically, I like this term, reason with you before Yahuwah concerning the righteous acts that he did to you and your fathers. When Jacob gone down into Egypt, your fathers cried out to Yahuwah. He sent Moshe and Aaron, brought them up out of Egypt, made them dwell in this place. Now here comes the indictment. And you forgot, they forgot, Yahuwah, their God. He sold them into the hand of Sisera, commander of the army of Hazor, into the hand of the Philistines, king of Moab, and they fought against them. And they cried out, and they said, whoa, we've done some bad stuff here. And we have served the Baals and the Ashtoreths. Isn't that interesting? Would it be that people would make the same claim today? Because Ashtoreth, Easter. Oh, yeah. There's a certain similarity in those names, isn't there? Similar kinds of things. In other words, folks, there's nothing new under the sun. But now deliver us from the hand of our enemies, and we will serve you. So Yahuwah sent Jerubbaal, Bedan, Jephthah, and Samuel, delivered you out of the hand of your enemies, and you dwelt in safety. And then you saw Nahash, king of the Ammonites. You said, no, Samuel, let's have a king to reign over us, when Yahuwah Eloheka was already your king. Now, I pause at this point because I'm going to suggest, folks, that there was a time in this land, and I'm talking about the United States, when the rallying cry, even though they maybe got the transliteration wrong, was no king but King Jesus. They didn't like evil kings. They put all kinds of constitutional barriers in place. Look what we have now in terms of somebody that arguably would be called Emperor Obamas the First. He ain't, in fact, the first emperor. We've had imperial edicts coming down from on high. People have behaved as if they were kings, and literally, you know, the law has been trodden for quite some time. But it's just that now things are getting pretty blunt. Like I said, I wanted to go through Samuel first. We'll come back to a few of those points, but I want to make sure that some of these similarities are literally just impossible to deny. So give us a king, they said. And there, Samuel pauses, and he says, now check it out, guys. Here is the king whom you've chosen, whom you've desired. Take note, Yahuwah has given you what you asked. You got a king. If you fear Yahuwah and serve him and obey his voice and do not rebel against the commandment of Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, then both you and the king who reigns over you will continue following Yahuwah, your God. However, if you will not obey the voice of Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, but instead rebel against his commandments, then the hand of Yahuwah will be against you, just as it was against your father. So, therefore, stand, see this great thing which Yahuwah is about to do for your before your eyes. And he now prophesies an interesting, if you will, sign, oat, comes to pass. Isn't today the wheat harvest, says Samuel? I'll call out to Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. He'll send thunder and rain that you can perceive and see just how great your wickedness is that you've done in the sight of Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh asking for a king. So he did what he said. He called out. Yahuwah sent thunder and rain that day, and the people feared greatly, both Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh and the prophet Samuel. Pray, he said, for your servants to Yahuwah Eloheka that we may not die. This is the people now speaking. Pray, they ask Samuel, for your servants to Yahuwah Eloheka, that we may not die. For we have added to all of our sins the evil of asking for a king for ourselves. Well, Samuel says, I'm not going to quit praying, and I'm going to teach you the good and the right way. The summary of the matter sounds a whole lot like the end of the book of Ecclesiastes. Only fear Yahuwah, serve him in truth with all your heart, and consider the great things he has done for you. But if you do wickedly, ain't going to be so good. You'll be swept away, both you and your king. All right, let's then talk about some of the kinds of wickedness that are out there in the world today. And this is kind of how I arranged what I guess I would say was a really nasty, busy week's worth of news. Let's talk just about a couple things. First, and let me ask this, give me some ones. I've talked about it during the news shows. Those of you who've heard my news shows during the week already know that that this happened on Monday. But I'm curious, how many people heard about the fact that this week, Monday, the 15th of July, on the Roman calendar anyway, was the 800th, precisely 8 centuries anniversary of something that, well, at least once upon a time was famous. Even grade school kids heard about it. It was called the signing of the Magna Carta, when the royals, the nobles, brought King John at sword point, made him sign this famous document that later became pretty much the basis for most of the English common law over centuries, and of course thereafter the basis for things like the Declaration of Independence and some of the great understandings of the law that at least once upon a time still existed in the United States. So give me some ones if you heard about the Magna Carta at Runnymede 800 years ago this week. Twos, if not, just because I thought it was interesting that it didn't get a lot of press, although I'm looking at a piece by Paul Craig Roberts. He wrote about it and made some of the history clear. Basically with this point, beginning with the various regimes that most of us remember. First Clinton, and then the two Bushes, the Obama regime. Arguably not much difference between them. Also places like England's Tony Blair. U.S. and U.K., a lot of these same English governments that were once held to the rights of Englishmen, later the rights of people, have now run roughshod over their accountability to law. A new slave existence is the way Robert summarizes this, being created in front of our eyes. As the law ceases to be a shield, becomes a weapon in the hands of government. Everywhere, privilege is rising at the nobility level, and it's coming up above law and justice, which are literally, well, as Jefferson put it, is a natural course of things for tyranny to gain ground and liberty to yield. So mostly twos, but several folks had heard about it. That's interesting, if nothing else. I want to throw out one other piece of good news, because after this, it's probably going to be downhill. Texas this week, and I think I mentioned this last week because it actually happened on Friday, but there was a lot more press that came out about it this week. Not only has established a gold depository, they're going to do the best they can to see if they can't get their gold back from the crooks that have it in New York, and they have even put into this law, it's a fairly toothy law. This is probably one of the best things that I've seen a state legislator do, or legislature, decades, I don't know. But they literally are standing on the Constitution, Article 1, and the idea that no state shall make anything but gold or silver coin, a tender in payment of debts. And they have said to the federal government and to the Fed, this is non-confiscatable. You guys are not going to come in here and take it. We will defend it. Whether they will, of course, remains to be seen. And what's interesting is they've also served notice that given that it's a state doing this, if there is any complaint by the feds, the first court of appeal... This goes directly to the Supreme Court. And Governor Greg Abbott made a pretty gutsy statement when he signed it, saying that we're going to become the first state-level facility of its kind in the nation. And the concern, of course, is 800 years after Magna Carta, there may be other states that actually see what Texas is doing and say, hey, that makes perfectly good sense. Now, at this point, I'm going to ask one other thing. There was another anniversary. No, not so much an anniversary as just an inauguration date of something insidiously evil. Same day as the Magna Carta. It was Jade Helm 15. So officially, at least, although arguably the troop movements, the prepositioning of if nothing else, troops designed to intimidate people and show them that the rule of law is a thing of the past in America, conditioning, in other words, propaganda, started on Monday, too. And isn't it funny, ha-ha, that the primary target of Jade Helm is the state of Texas. No coincidences here. This day, literally overnight, last night I saw the first notes in it, and it happened again today. The European Central Bank, we're still talking kind of sort of about money and following the money and understanding what's going on. European Central Bank literally told the Greek people, you want to put a run on your bank? Yeah, go for it. Banks may not even be open on Monday. Now, these are the same folks, of course, that if you basically said, something that would cause a run on a bank here, they'd probably call that a crime. You're inciting a panic. How dare you do that? But when the ECB blesses a bank run, saying they're not sure if the banks are even going to be open on Monday or not, well, the Greek finance minister was right. He said that these people were criminally trying to incite capital flight and literally create a panic. But we're not too surprised about that. Yeah, comments on the screen. I've heard any number of people, some of them are here in this room, saying all over the Colorado. I've seen reports all over the United States, incredible troop movements, unlike anything that's been seen in most of our lifetimes. Things are happening. Not necessarily good things. And speaking of not good things, I'm sure most of you heard about this because the Waste Stream has been talking about it a lot. There were 9 people killed, tragically, in another shooting. Some of us are even wondering, I don't have the data yet, and if Big Brother is true to form, it'll probably be hard to get to. But it certainly stinks anyway, on so many fronts. A young kid on yet another mind-altering drug marched into a church in South Carolina and killed 9 people. And he basically said he wanted to start a race war. Others are pointing out that the FBI has been the source of virtually every fake terror plot and false flag operation that we've seen for several years now. Generally, it's because there's a confidential informant providing not only the ideas and the means, but in many cases, the weapons, too. Which is why I thought it was funny that Obama's the first was, trotting on the graves here immediately saying, too many guns! We got to get rid of your right to keep and bear arms! And, of course, they're going to do that by hook or by crook. If he doesn't do it with the almighty pen, they'll stick it secretly into TPP. It's already been pretty well revealed that it's there. And what really bugs me was the outright contradiction. Yeah, he's concerned when a few people are killed because Americans still have guns. Now, the folks in the church didn't have a gun. They weren't able to stop. One of the reports said that the evil murderer actually reloaded 5 times, if you can believe that. Nobody was able to stop him. Although, some are saying that there's a backfiring, because I saw a whole bunch of stories that a lot of folks that were anti-gun before are saying, maybe we better get some guns. Well, better to be armed in the face of what's coming than not, arguably. But if there's a real contradiction here that bugs me, it's the idea that when literally hundreds, if not many thousands of Christians by this point have been killed, massacred, beheaded by ISIS troops and others all across the Mideast and down into Africa, you name it, ISIS, CIA, trained and armed by the U.S. military, which used to make a very good point of destroying weapons lest they fall into evil hands. When it comes to Islamic terrorists, funded and armed now by the U.S. military, not so much. So the very same guy that's saying we want to disarm you peons so that we can do what we want here is not having any problem at all with terrorists wearing the ISIS banner being armed with guns that mere American peons can't even have. If you don't find that contradiction downright disgusting, I guess there's something wrong. This story, too, this just came out this afternoon from Prison Planet via Amnesty International, which has released a new report saying that literally every state in the United States is failing to comply with what they say are the minimum international standards on the lethal use of force by police. There's a whole bunch of statistics in here, but basically their director, Stephen Hawkins, told the London Guardian that the findings are evidence that law enforcement departments in the U.S. have, quote, a shocking lack of fundamental respect for the sanctity of human life. So in the same week where, tragically, there were people killed in a church by a nasty, evil, bad guy, whether he was an MKUltra or a false flag or inspired and armed by the FBI, again, we probably won't hear about that. And the information about the drugs he was taking will no doubt be removed from the web fairly soon. But this, nevertheless, is hard to argue with. Here are the numbers, folks. Another study from Fatal Encounters points out that in the last 15 years, there have been an average over 1,000 people in the U.S. killed every year by police. 1,000 people a year killed in the United States by the no longer protect and serve police. And even this group admits that that's probably a pretty low number, because it may be as many as 3 times that, and they're simply not getting reported. 1,000 in the United States. Now, Obama's the first was saying, too many guns, too many guns. But did you know that that's about 50 times more people killed by police than are killed by mass shootings on average every year, too? And by the way, this number compares with 3 in the UK, 12 in Canada, and about 4 on average in Germany. Something is wrong here, and it's not an armed populace. That's for darn sure. All right, back to the man who would be king. Well, I guess we've already kind of done a few stories on that. But I want to point this out as well. Now, this is another one of those of you that know me know that I may have to stop as I'm doing this story. Take a couple of deep breaths, because the long-anticipated papal encyclical has come out announcing another new god, bogus science. Yes, the Pope Francis has now come out and released the climate change encyclical. People are rightfully calling it Agenda 21 on steroids, and pointing out that one of the chief papal spokespersons is a supposed atheist and a pretty scummy fella. The guy's name is Professor John Schellenhuber, Achtung, and he has a daydream about a planetary court and a new Earth constitution with a world government, all of which would have the goal, as he puts it, to remove some 6 or so billion people that, you know, the surplus population just needs to die. And I guess if you're going to use bogus science, why not? So what really irritates me about this, folks, is that in the name of a fake god, Remember, the Catholic Church is the church that essentially changed times and seasons. I know, am I Catholic bashing? Not Catholics per se, although I would say a lot of people are hideously deceived to think that some man can put on a Dagon-style fish hat and that gives him the authority to override the Word of God himself and change Scripture. I sometimes sarcastically joke, and I think it bears repeating here, that what the Pope does when he sits on the so-called throne of St. Peter and speaks, what do they call it, ex cathedra? I forget the various Latin names for we will call God up on the red phone, tell him what he got wrong today. But that's what happened here. They're saying man-made global climate change is happening. Yeah, it is man-made. And it takes a world communist government. And guess what, folks? That's not a very well-veiled argument either in order to combat this. So they're literally trying to mobilize a billion people to move in the direction of, I guess you'd have to say, self-immolation in a lot of way. Yeah, I see on the screen. I can't argue with that. Francis's Gaia encyclical. This is insidiously downright evil stuff. Now, in a piece that came out earlier this week, Mike Adams at Natural News says, hey, how do they kill 6 billion people besides bogus science and similar kinds of things? Answer, did you ever see the Bruce Willis movie called 12 Monkeys? Just release a weaponized, genetically engineered virus at major airports around the world and step back. If the CDC has the patents on it, so much the better. You know what, folks? Seriously, it is tough not to be downright cynical when you see all of this stuff coming together and when you see the very same things literally being, it would appear, coordinated to come out during the same week. We had TPP, TPA, Fast Track, let's hide all this insidiously evil stuff in a so-called trade bill. And, of course, it was slammed through the Senate, railroaded through. Nobody still knows what's in it. Most of those senators aren't about to read it. They're not going to be allowed to. Or they won't bother anyway. And then it supposedly went to the House, where it suffered a narrow defeat, but not really. They just waited a couple days and then revoted on a slightly different version of it, and it slammed right on through. And on the very same day, well, let's just say we had some unfortunate events in South Carolina that conveniently managed to get all that off the front pages and completely change the news focus. One more story. Now we're going to change to follow the money, because the money is still the bottom line here. Dishonest weights and measures, the abomination. The Fed's Open Market Committee, the Order of the Money Changers, the Fed Church, literally, their worship service was Wednesday. Now, Zero Hedge just pointed out there are a couple things you can always count on. During the week that the Fed is going to do their church service and tell people what Mount Olympus's gods told them the money supply needs to be and what they're going to do, well, you can count on the paper casinos hammering gold for about $30 on average. This week was no exception. Went back up again, of course, once the church service was over. And they lied one more time. They keep telling people, we're gonna taper. Oh, real soon now, we're gonna think about commencing to maybe talk about doing it someday. But not today. And even Goldman Sachs says, well, probably not gonna happen now. Maybe it'll happen later. But you know the Fed will be telling us it's gonna happen real soon. Meanwhile, the Chinese Shanghai Containerized Freight Index has totally collapsed. World shipping literally is at an incredible collapsing rate. Shipping containers now are cheaper than dirt. And the shippers, some of the major ocean shipping lines are shipping. Here's a couple of European carriers talking to Wolf Richter, Wolf Street. We are now shipping at an absolute loss. Basically, they are, for every box they ship, they're losing $50 a box, and that's below the cost of fuel for these things. In other words, you know, world trade has fallen off a cliff. In the United States, beef prices hit another record. They're up 30% in the last 2 years, but there's no inflation. And then finally this. The Fed, of course, not only lied, but I like this summary from Jeffrey Snyder of Alhambra Investment Partners. He said the FOMC is trying to scare a recovery into existence. Their predictions have been, in a word, atrocious. The economy is a disaster, in spite of the fact that they keep touting the no inflation lie and the recovery real soon now lie. They keep dropping the GDP. This year is going to be worse than last year. And so how are we supposed to assume the Fed is even more convinced the economy has gotten better, even if it's only because the economy has gotten worse? In other words, he's pointing out the contradictions. Everything about the FOMC meeting this week suggested there is nothing going on to even suggest or hint at a recovery. The fact that the economy in 2015 was just reduced to something worse than last year's pace, despite the fact that every FOMC member, including Helicopter Janet, has spent months and months last year and a good part of this year telling everyone that what's just happened was completely impossible. So rather than admit their mistake, they're doubling down. It's a mockery of common sense, he says. And while this was going on, the one good journalist that's asking about corruption in the Fed, a fellow named Pedro de Costa from the Wall Street Journal, he asked an embarrassing question at the last Fed meeting, and they told him, don't show your face again this time. So he was, during the Fed's meeting on Wednesday, tweeting something called Ask Yellen. Why did the Fed fail to follow up on the criminal leaks that basically released the Fed minutes to the insider banksters ahead of time? Answer? Nobody's going to ask that. You can count on it. What has the Western central bankers so terrified? Ask others. Answer? Well, here's Egon von Greyers from the Swiss folks. The die is cast. The world is now on its way to a secular decline of a magnitude, he says, never seen before in history. No central bank, no country can stop the inevitable implosion now of all the asset and debt bubbles that have literally been built up for an entire century. Fed doesn't have a clue what to do. I'm not sure if that's true, but I guarantee you whatever it is, they ain't going to do it. And for quite a while, the Fed has been telling the markets there'd be a rate increase at the meeting this week. Of course, that didn't happen, so we know what's going to happen now. There'll be more and more and more social unrest as the rest of the world follows Greece. So watch Greece. Understand what's going on, that Greece is a beta test. Get your money out of the bank as if your life depends on it, because it does, said a story from Graham's Gold earlier this week. Literally what's happening, Charles Hugh Smith. The Fed is funneling the herd off a cliff. This is a fairly complicated piece about how they're suppressing volatility and propping up markets. But essentially what they've done is they have driven down yields on bonds so low that, well, people on fixed incomes, retirees, they can't find any gain. There's nobody paying any interest. The banks even are now paying negative interest. They're talking about capital controls and cash controls, all that kind of stuff. Why would you put your money in a bank where they may steal it if you know you're not going to get as much back as you put in, for crying out loud? Deutsche Bank, too. Is it the next Lehman? So for all of these reasons, essentially, by the way, even Ron Paul. Now, I like Ron Paul, as some of you know. He was one of my favorite interviews when I used to do an interview show years ago. But one of the things that I noticed, particularly when he was in Congress, is he was very circumspect. In other words, he would tell me privately, oh, things are going to be ugly. But as far as, in public, he didn't want to be accused of, well, like what the ECB did this week, causing a bank run, telling people how bad it is. But earlier today, one of the major news shows, I think it was CNBC, he came out and said, it's going to be ugly, folks. So more and more, just about everybody who knows what's going on is being forced to admit, this is going to be some kind of ugly. I guess we'll talk about some of these other things later. I'll end with a little note of caution, and this is my concern. It's very obvious in the United States that I think what's happening here is there's an attempt to create a war, perhaps on several fronts. I didn't even mention what's going on in the South China Sea this week or the Balkans, but more and more and more troop mobilizations there, just like we're seeing troop mobilizations in Texas and across the U.S. Looks like things are coming to a head. And in Greece, people are really, really angry. They've been taking out the better part of $1 billion a day for several days, and it probably accelerated today. There was a story in Zero Hedge saying that retirees are saying that the creditors are literally acting like grave diggers. They're trying to send us pensioners to an early grave. And another guy came out and said, look, if they are trying to turn us into a murderer, they may be successful. Quote, if they come to seize my house, I'm going to take the head off of whoever's standing there. And I'm not the only one thinking that way. So we're seeing more and more tensions being built up in this, too. I guess that's the caution, again. As things get really ugly, The time to make the decision, make the planning, do the come out of her my people thing is now, before it gets really ugly. Because when things really do get ugly, people tend to, mobs tend to be ugly things. And for those that are not walking in obedience, how can you expect his protection? This is the time to think about all that. In other words, do the right thing now so that when the wrong thing happens, because you already were warned that it would, you're not caught between a rock and a hard place and therefore fall into the trap of violating his word and his Torah. This is all important stuff to follow. All right, any questions or comments? I hope the connection at least is obvious. If it's not, when we talk about Korah's rebellion here in a minute, I'll try to connect some of the few remaining dots. But it certainly looks like during the time of Samuel, the people asked for a king and they got one. And lo and behold, there's nothing new under the sun. The people of America, sadly, have asked for a king. And they got themselves an emperor and worse. A lot of us, however, aren't asking. And we know that the answer is to come out and not participate in that. So, with that, join me, if you will, and turn in your Bibles to the beginning of this week's Torah portion, which is Korach. And it's actually, it's got the chet on the end, rather than the way most English speakers pronounce it, Korah. But it's actually Korach in the Hebrew. And it begins by telling us who he is. Son of Itzar, son of Kohath, son of Levi. So he is one of the Levites. And he has a pretty exalted position. He's not the high priest, mind you. But let's follow the rest of the story. He, along with a couple of other folks, Dathan and Abiram, sons of Eliab and On, sons of Reuben, they got themselves a bunch of men. They basically incited a little something here, and they rose up in the face of Moshe with certain of the children of Israel, 250 men who were literally called princes of the congregation. They were elect, they were elders, they were men of renown, and they assembled themselves against Moshe and against Aaron, and they said the following. Now, a whole lot has been made, as you might suspect, in the various midrashim about a lot of the things here. There's a lot of speculation, of course. What is Korah's motive? It would seem that power is probably a pretty obvious one, but maybe there's a bit more to it. They basically said, you guys take too much upon yourselves, seeing how all of the congregation, they're all holy, they're all set apart. Al-Kahal. The assembly. Every one of them. Yahuwah is among them. So why are you lifting up yourselves above the Kahal of Yahuwah? And when Moshe heard this, something about it really upset him. He fell on his face. He spoke to Korah and he said, look, in the morning, Yahuwah is going to show you who are his, who is truly set apart, and will cause to come near unto him those whom he wants to. He will choose. So here's the deal. Go get your censers, Korah, all your company. Put some fire in them. Put some incense in them. And before Yahuwah tomorrow, it'll be the man that Yod-Heh Vav-Heh chooses. He will be the one that is set apart. And he says it again. Y'all, you're taking too much upon yourselves, you sons of Levi. Moshe says to Korah, hear now, is it a small thing to you? And this is the interesting part here, I think, too, that Elohim of Israel has separated you out of the congregation of Israel. He's brought you near. You got a pretty darn high position here, guys, to do the service of the tabernacle before Yod-Heh Vav-Heh, to minister and to stand before the congregation. He's brought you near, and all the sons of Levi. You going to look for the priesthood, too? Ain't that enough for you? So therefore, you and all your company that are gathered against Yod-Heh Vav-Heh, and as to Aaron, who's he that you murmur against him too? So Moshe calls to the other two henchmen here, Dathan and Abiram, and they said, we ain't going to come up. Now, I think this part is interesting as well. Let me just make a couple of comments that some of you know. I really get a kick out of Rabbi David Foreman. His comments, and he notes a number of things about this parsha, and I'm going to just outline a couple of them that I think are really key. One, this idea, and I think this is part of the reason why I did the news and stuff up front, because he says, look, if you think about it, all of us are holy, hey, every person, doesn't that sound a little bit like communism? It really does. Now, it's interesting, too, and this is the observation that I will add to that. You got these basically self-styled folks who are power-hungry that will make that claim every time. You notice that? I don't think Korah is really concerned about the people and about how they're all holy. I think he's just really concerned about, well, Korah. And maybe there's a few other things going on here as well. But it looks like, at least among those that are following him, there are several different issues. The Midrash points out that these 250 men of renown, they may have had some different motivation. Some speculate that they really knew that they wanted to be close to Elohim, and they were willing to know that they might die in the process. Interesting. I'm not sure if I would quite go there, but essentially they're saying we're so willing to do this that we're willing to die in the process. We want to just get closer to God. Now, you got to remember one other thing about this situation, and this does fit. These people have just been told your carcasses, you know, your you-know-whats are going to be rotten in the desert out here pretty quick. May take 40 years, but you ain't going to go into the land. And that's it for you. They've literally got a death sentence on them, kind of like a life sentence in prison in the desert, and after that they're going to die and they're not going to see the land. So you might suspect that they're just a little bit bummed out at this point. Maybe the 250 are saying, yeah, better to die now in a blazing ball of glory, which is kind of how it turns out, than to just spend 40 years roaming around out here. Which brings me to the next comment, and we see that we will not come up. And this was something that that Foreman pointed out. If you go look at the language in several of these places, you notice that what we saw with the children of Israel right after they outvoted 10-2, right? The spies outvoted the two guys who are going to get to walk into the land, Caleb and Joshua. The rest of them say, oh, we'll go up, we'll go up, we'll go up. Well, it's a little bit late, guys. And they went up anyway. No, no, said Moshe, don't do that. You're going to get your you-know-whats kicked. Oh, we're going to go up. And they did. And they did. They got kicked hard. They came back down with their tails between their legs. So what is it that Dathan and Abiram say when they're told, come on up, I want to talk to you? Answer, we will not come up. Very same wording. In other words, it sounds like these guys are really, really angry. As a matter of fact, the sages suggest that they were literally in a state of rage. And you kind of see that in the way they talk. And it does sound a little bit like the whining. I've been accused of talking about a lot of whole lot of whining going on for a long time. I guess I stand guilty of that. Is it a small thing, they say in this what would appear to be rage, is it a tiny small thing that you have brought us up out of our wonderful bondage? No, that's not how they put it. Out of a land flowing with milk and honey. Ironic, isn't it? That's the very terminology that Elohim uses for the land that they're going to go in. No, no, no. It's a land we came out of. Talk about rubbing people's noses in it. That's what they're trying to do here. You brought us up out of a land flowing with milk and honey to kill us here in the wilderness. You need to make yourself a prince over us now, too? Moreover, you haven't brought us into a land flowing with milk and honey, nor given us our inheritance of fields and vineyards. You're going to pull out the eyes of these men? We won't come up. And as you might suspect, Moshe was pretty upset about that. And he said to Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, do not respect their offering. This does sound a little bit like what Samuel said, doesn't it? Right here. I haven't taken one ass from them, nor have I hurt one of them. Then he says to Korah, you, all those guys with you, come before Yahuwah tomorrow, and you and them and Aaron, we'll just see what happens. Take every man his fire pan, put incense, bring them on up there, 250 of them, and also Aaron and his. Almost like the showdown at the OK Corral. You can pretty well, if you didn't already know it, you know how this is going to turn out, right? We'll come back to the story in just a second, but there's one more thing I want to mention, and sometimes I do this up front. The Torah portion this week is named, first unique set of words in the parsha, right? Chapter 16, verse 1. It says, Ve Yikach Korach, the son of Itzar, Ben Itzar. So here comes Korah. Korah, Korah. Okay, so there you go. The first unique word in this parsha, name of the guy that is going to do the rebellion. So it is called Korach. And it's Kuf Resh Chet. Now, what's interesting about that, a lot of folks point out is that the name, literally, the closest that you'll see to a Hebrew word is Karcha, which is the name given to a bald spot. So Korah's name kind of has a connotation of a dude with a bald spot. Do we think that's what's going on here? No. Really, it probably has more to do with Deuteronomy chapter 14, where it says you're not to cut the hair off your head in mourning for the dead. Basically, it's forbidden because it's something that the Amorites did, the pagans did. And what David Foreman goes through and shows that if you look at Deuteronomy 14 and you look in the Hebrew and you look at some of the words here, that it's not just that similarity. There are others, too, in the wording. The "we're all holy" part is a very similar set of words that shows up in Deuteronomy 14. Because you all are holy, so don't be doing this kind of stuff. And it kind of starts to fit. If you step back and ask, what's going on? Could there be some kind of mourning for the dead going on here? We're dead to men already. I remember the line from Star Trek. Oh, he's dead already. And maybe that's to a certain extent what they're thinking. Korah's either going to be the head honcho, or he might as well be dead already. Because they've been told, right? This is it. Your carcass is going to rot out here. May take a while. This mourning. This idea of rage, too, right? Remember the phases of something bad happens? Starts with denial. Oh, no, we'll go on up now. Nope, it's too late, guys. So they deny first that it's too late. The next thing, of course, is rage. We're seeing that. And what this forbidden grief, the bald spot, the karcha, is all about, ultimately is self-mutilation. They mutilate the head. And maybe they're kind of trying to do that too with Moshe. Going to mutilate the head here. Pull out the hair. No doubt, Korach is a jealous guy. And there's one more element that I guess before we get to the thrilling climax of the story that I need to point out. And I had to go look this one up because it turns out if you go through the names of all the people that sent emissaries, right, 12 tribes, into the land to spy out the land. Did you notice one was missing? Yeah, it was Levi. So maybe, some have suggested, maybe Korah's a little upset. Hey, we weren't even represented among the spies here. But in any case, there's a whole lot of rage to go around. And if they're not fixing to pull out their own hair and cut off their own heads, figuratively at least, in this grief and rage, something bad is going to happen very quickly. One more observation, I guess, too. Okay, I want to make sure we get all of this on the table as we go through. I did the news up front tonight. Talked about the Haftorah portion up front tonight and Samuel's observations at the coronation of Saul. We have a rebellion going on here. Immediately after this debacle of the spies, where everyone is told you are not going to see the land because you've blown it, we get a rebellion. Now, what's funny, of course, in a way, not funny haha, but funny weird, is if there was ever a leader in history that you'd think by now they would have realized, this guy's kind of anointed, isn't he, to stand up here and be the leader, it would be Moshe. We've had demonstration after demonstration of that. What's it going to take, right? I've asked that before as we go through the Torah portion. Compare some of this to what's going on today. Ironically, today we got people just the opposite. I contend that it's the opposite phase of the cycle, where we have people, though lawful right to be king, that are taking too much upon themselves. These are the Korahs that made it, and are basically now shaking their fist at God, saying, ha ha, we'll do whatever we damn well want to do. We'll bring about a living hell on earth, and we'll lust in it the whole way. You name it. If it's a violation of Torah, they're rubbing people's noses in it and getting rid of all of those who won't follow along. So, yeah, Korah is kind of the opposite situation. And what I find kind of interesting, too, about this idea of grief and the Ammonite practices of mourning and of self-mutilation and all that kind of jazz, and I've mentioned this before, look around at the younger generation today. Oh, I know, this is going to be perceived as negative, and so be it. Because the Bible talks about not making cuttings in your flesh for the dead. We got all kinds of people. You go look at one of the epidemics that the psychologists will tell you is out there. It's mutilation. It's mutilation, kids cutting themselves, kids piercing themselves. Look at some of the things you see in the magazines and on TV. Talk about mutilation and so forth. And the tattooing and all kinds of other stuff. And they're not necessarily, oh, we got butterflies. Yeah, we got the skulls and the crossbones and the chains and the barbed wire and all that other kind of stuff, too. Mutilation, in other words, is a downright epidemic today. And it's associated with some of the very same things that we're seeing here with Dathan and Abiram, the rage. Oh, we want to go back to bondage. We want to go back. That was the land with milk and honey, that land where we were slaves. And don't think for a second that that's not exactly the psychological imperative that drives a whole lot of what seems to be going on around the United States and indeed the Western world today. I guess what I would call it is rebellion then and now. And like I said, it's about more than just power. It's about an anger and a rage at the Creator, too, that manifests itself in so many of these ways. And maybe it's not the case with the 250, but it certainly does seem that, well, let's just see how it plays out. So everybody took their fire pan, they put fire in them, they laid their incense, they stood at the door of the tent of meeting, and there's Moshe and Aaron. Korah got all of his guys together too against them. And at the door of the tent of meeting, and the glory of Yahuwah appeared to Kol Ha'edah, all the congregation. And Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh spoke to Moshe and Aaron, he said the following, move away from them. Separate yourselves from the congregation, that I may consume them in a moment. And they fell upon their faces, and they said, O Elohim, Elohim of all the ruachs, the spirits, ruachim of the flesh, shall this one man sin? And you basically take it out on the whole congregation? Korah's going to be punished, is the way Rashi put it. The one man sins. He sinned for sure. But how about the others? That's essentially the question that's being asked by Moshe and Aaron. And Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh spoke to Moshe this time, and he says, speak to the congregation and tell them, get away from Le Mishkan. Mishkan, we remember that name. That's the tent in this case. It's the same word that's used for the tabernacle in the wilderness. Get away from the Mishkan of Korah and Dathan and Abiram. You see what's going to happen? Moshe rose up. He went unto Dathan and Abiram, the elders of Israel followed him, and he said to the congregation, get out of here, depart, I pray you, from the tents of these wicked men. And don't even touch any of their stuff, because it ain't going to be pretty, lest you be swept away in their sins. So all these folks got up from the tents of Korah and Dathan and Abiram on every side. Dathan and Abiram came out. They stood at the door of their tents with their wives and their sons and their little ones. Moshe said the following, this is how you shall know that Yahuwah has sent me to do these works, and that I have not done them of my own heart, my lev, me levi, my heart. If these men die the common, you know, good old-fashioned death of all men, and they be visited at the visitation of all men, in other words, if natural causes bring them to their eventual graves, then Yahuwah hasn't sent me. But, now this is interesting, but if Yahuwah does a new thing here, a new thing, Rashi says, death by swallowing as the earth's mouth literally opens up. Well, maybe that's kind of a new thing. And that's what happened. The ground opened her mouth. Literally, swallowed them up, and everything that appertained to them, and they went down alive into the pit. Well, if he does that, then you'll know that these men have literally despised, provoked Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. Not me. And now he attributes it to Yahuwah. And it came to pass, as soon as he finished speaking these words, the ground cleaved asunder beneath them. The earth opened her mouth and swallowed them up. Their households, all the men that appertained unto Korah and all their goods. They went down alive into the pit. The earth closed over them, and they perished from among the assembly. And all Israel's around them fled. And they said, whoa, lest the earth eat us, swallow us up alive too. Fire came forth from Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. Different deal now for the 250. And it devoured those guys that were offering the incense. Let's pause, because at chapter 17, now we get a slight pause in the narrative. Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh says something interesting to Moshe. He says, speak to Eleazar, son of Aaron the priest. Tell him to get all those fire pans out of the burning ash pit over there. Scatter the fire yonder, for they are become set apart. The fire pans from these burned up dudes, those men who have sinned at the cost of their lives, gather them up. Let them be beaten into plates for a covering of the altar, because they have become set apart. They were offered before Yahuwah. Let that now be a sign, oat, unto the children of Israel. So Eleazar did what he was told, took those brazen fire pans, beat them out for a covering, to be a memorial to the children of Israel, to the end that no common man, no one who is not of the seed of Aaron, is to draw near to burn incense before Yahuwah, so that he learns a lesson, does not fare as Korah. But on the morrow, all those children of Israel... I pause. Wait a second. Come on, folks. I say it one more time. What's it going to take? How many times do they have to whine and do what it is that they ought to by now, for crying out loud, know better than to do? If there is a continuing, repeating moral, this is the human condition. Blind. On the morrow, it says, verse 6, all of the congregation of the children of Israel murmured against Moshe and against Aaron, saying, y'all have killed the people of the Lord. Oh, really? Like you weren't paying attention, huh? When it came to pass, then the congregation was assembled against Moshe and Aaron. They looked at the tent of meeting. Behold, here comes the cloud. And Moshe and Aaron went up front, and Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh spoke to them. Can you guess what's coming? I know most of us have read it before, but let's read it anyway. Get yourselves up, lift yourselves up, he said, from among this congregation. Something bad is fixing to happen. Yeah, that I may consume them in a moment. They fell upon their faces. Moshe, to his credit, I guess, could see it coming. Again, been there, done that, right? Moshe says to Aaron, get your fire pan, get some fire on that sucker, lay the incense, and run, man, run out into the congregation. Make atonement for them, for the wrath has gone out from Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. The plague has already begun. I suspect that there is a scene of Moshe, literally, how old was this guy? He's well up into his 80s at this point, and he's probably sprinting pretty good for an old dude. Aaron took as Moshe spoke. He ran into the midst of the assembly. Behold, there it is. The plague has begun. He put on the incense. He made atonement. And he literally stood between the dead and the living. And I've got written in my margin here, the plague was cauterized. I mean, picture something spreading that fast. It was cauterized. You ready for the numbers? Those that died by the plague were 14,700. The scene has got to be amazing. Moshe and Aaron standing up there looking at the crowd, and what's happening? 14,700 people. That's, a good quarter of a full-sized football or baseball stadium full of people dropping like flies. You've seen the wave, right, at a crowd? They're standing up. Well, this is they're dropping down like flies. And that's 14,700 besides those that had already been fried and eaten by the earth's mouth yesterday. What's it going to take, right? Moshe and Aaron returned to the door of the tent of meeting. The plague was stayed. And Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh speaks again. He says, speak to the children of Israel. Get yourself, take them some rods. Have each one of their father's houses take a rod, a staff, of the princes according to their father's house. Get 12 rods. Write every man's name upon them. Put Aaron's name on there too. His will be the rod of Levi. one rod for the heads of the fathers' houses. Lay them up in the tent of meeting before the testimony where I meet with you, and then let's just check it out and see what happens. See, it'll come to pass that the man whom I choose, his rod will bud, and I will make to cease from me the murmurings of B'nai Israel, the whining, the things that they murmur against you. So Moshe told him what was going on. All the princes gave him their rods, put their names on it, 12 of them. Aaron's rod was among them. They laid the rods before Yahuwah in the testimony, in the tent of meeting. And it comes to pass that when Moshe goes in there, behold, the rod of Aaron for the house of Levi had not only budded, and it had put forth lots of buds, it had bloomed blossoms, and it even had ripe almonds on it. So Moshe brings them all out. They looked. Check out your rods, guys. And Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh says to Moshe, put Aaron's back in there to be kept as a token against the rebellious children. So they'll learn about the murmurings here. Maybe they'll stop. And so that they die not, too. So Moshe did as Yahuwah commanded him. So he did. You notice how Scripture tells us things like that? I had this discussion today on several different forums on the web. People, trotting out the same old tired stuff. Oh, the law is done away with, nailed to the cross. And they'll twist one verse of Paul and deny every other place, including the words of Yeshua himself, where he said, ain't so. I'm the same yesterday, today, and tomorrow. I change not, says the prophet Malachi in this case. How many times do we see this too? Moshe did what he was commanded. As Yahuwah commanded him, so he did. How hard is that? But it makes a really big point. Aaron did this as he was commanded. So he did. Yeah. Is that really that difficult? Oh, well, nobody can keep the law. Bull! Matter of fact, Deuteronomy 30, and I had people lie about this one too. No, it doesn't say what you think it says. Well, what do you mean it doesn't say that? Can't you read it? You can read it in Hebrew, you can read it in English. Heck, you could probably even read it in Greek and get it. It's not too hard for you. You can do it. Moshe did, as he was commanded, so he did. Over and over again, we get that same message. All right, well, when it comes to the children of Israel, maybe not so much. They spoke to Moshe saying, we perish, we are undone, we are all undone. Everyone comes near the tabernacle. The Mishkan is going to die. Shall we wholly perish? Maybe the whining isn't going to stop. Yahuwah says to Moshe, chapter 18, this is the last part of the portion for tonight. You and your sons, your father's house, will bear the iniquity of the sanctuary. You and your sons shall bear the iniquity of your priesthood. Your brothers too, tribe of Levi and your father. Bring those near with you that they may be joined unto you and minister unto you. You, your sons, with you being before the tent of the testimony. They will keep the charge and the charge of all the tent. And then basically what he's going to do is repeat some things we've seen before. They're not to come nigh to the holy furniture, the set-apart things, the altar, that they die not. And basically we're going to get another review of the responsibilities of the priests and the Levites. And then he says, verse 4, it's a common man, though, is not to draw nigh unto you. Keep charge of the various set-apart things, so that there's no more wrath upon the B'nai Israel. Behold, I've taken you out. You are given as a gift, right, the replacement firstborn unto Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, to do the service of the tent of meeting. I give you this priesthood, he says, as a service of a gift. And then he repeats a whole bunch of other things about where you're supposed to do certain things, who can eat, every male may eat of these various set-apart offerings made by fire, the meal offerings, the sin offerings, the guilt offerings. They're to be set apart holy for you and your sons. The best of the oil, the best of the wine, the corn, all of those things I have given to them, meaning the Levites, the ripe fruits of the land, things they bring to Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. Those are to be mine. Everyone that is clean in your house may eat of it. Everything that is devoted, cherem, in Israel, is to be yours. All those things that open the womb of all flesh that they offer unto Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, both man and beast, will be yours too. Firstborn of man, though, you will redeem. First things of the unclean beasts you're to redeem. And this redemption money, he describes how much that is and what's going to happen and the specifics of it there. Let's cut to the chase, towards the end. You are to set apart these things, the things that you receive as a gift. They're to be set apart unto Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, to Aaron the priest, and of course then later to those that follow after him. Out of all that is given, you're to set apart that which is due unto Yahuwah, all the best part, the hallowed part. So when you say unto them, when you set apart the best, it shall be counted unto the Levites, as the increase of the threshing floor, the increase of the winepress. And you may eat of it in every place, you and your households. This is your reward in return for your service in the tent of meeting. You bear no sin by reason of it, seeing that you have set apart from it the best. You're not to profane the set apart things of the children of Israel, that you die not. Still an important lesson. All right, let me just ask questions, comments. I see it looks like we had some dropouts, but hopefully things are back at this point. I guess what sticks out at me, and it's part of the reason, again, that I chose to do the news first, is we see the cycles repeat. Pendulum swings back and forth, and at certain times we see things that seem to be kind of the opposite of what's going on. And in other words, in this case, the way I would look at the world nowadays, we certainly don't have a Moshe on the scene. We've got a Korah running things, if you will. And it does look a lot more like the other side of the coin in the time of Samuel, the prophet, when he is talking about Saul. You ask for a king, you got one. Sometimes it's better you don't get what you ask for. And the same thing is arguably true here. But nevertheless, the human condition remains the same. We've still got the kind of rebellion going on, the kind of rage going on, and the kind of self-mutilation that's going on. And sometimes, you know, you shake your head and you step back and you say, I don't quite understand it. Why would people among the children of Israel who know, who've seen miracles, why would they keep doing the same stupid stuff? But then again, I look at the world today and I say, come on, why would people keep doing the same stupid stuff today? Why would they do stuff that brings destruction? Why would they shake their fists in the face of the living God, tell him he's not welcome in the schools, the courts, and then wonder why it is that there's no justice and why their economic system, oh, well, it looks really good. Yeah, well, the cancer is rotting it out from within. Horrible, wrong stuff going on. But ultimately, the message is kind of sort of the same, consistently. Quit the whining, quit the murmuring, make teshuva, return, and do our very best to fall back into line, to understand what's going wrong, and to try to make progress in a different direction. It's not like there aren't plenty, I mean plenty, of good examples and evil examples out there so that we can do exactly what we're told. Choose. Choose this day whom you will serve. Life and blessing, death and cursing, there it is. Make the choice. Can't serve two masters, pick the right one. For crying out loud, it ought to be obvious.